work on in my area. And then I want to talk about a few specific problems and some specific examples to show you some details the kind of things we do. So let's just get started here. So first of all, when you do non-commutative geometry, what does it mean? It means your functions don't commute, right? So that's a definition of non-commutative geometry. So we need to look at non-commutative algebras. So I'm going to start off with some maybe the simplest non-commutative algebras we know. Matrices are the easiest non-commutative algebras around. Another very simple example you're all familiar with probably is quaternions. So one reason to write down these examples is just to make you more familiar with the kind of notation I'm going to be using. So you'll notice, first off, I use this notation for matrices, not MN. And another thing I'm going to do is I want to show you the notation I'm going to use for generators and relations. Okay, so I'll be writing angle brackets like this for generators and have lists of relations like this. This is just a way of presenting the quaternions. And here's a presentation of matrices with two generators. So matrix algebra can be written, two generators satisfying these equations here, where zeta is a primitive nth root of unity. And if you want to, you can, as an exercise, you can work out that this gives the isomorphism. If you pick that x and that y, you can write down this isomorphism with matrices explicitly. So those examples aren't very geometric. So I want to talk about some examples that have more of a flavor of geometry to them, more algebraic geometry. And so here's some examples that I would consider surfaces. So there's the quantum plane. And so this example, it has two variables. It's like polynomials where we have this non-zero scalar in C that skews the multiplication. That's one example. Here's another example. It's the Weyl algebra. Again, it's a very similar example. So why would I call these non-commutative surfaces? I mean, what makes them surfaces or spaces or so on? Well, here's a few good properties they have. So they have several nice properties in common with polynomial functions. So they both have a basis of xij. Well, I guess it's del here. So they have the same size as polynomial rings. They're both domains. So for some reason in non-commutative algebra, we drop the word integral in front of domains. So it means just the usual definition of an integral domain. And they have lots of good homological algebra properties. And so I'm going to list some of those later, but I'm not going to get into them into a lot of detail and go on. But that's another important consideration for us. So the next example I want to mention is kind of really the foundations of the subject. So I'm going to do, I'm going to throw in the maximal number of physics comments I can, which are going to be very small. And I'm going to say the same things a few other people have said, which is please don't ask me any questions about them at all, because I'll have no idea. I don't really know about physical connections of this material, but I'd love to know more about that. So these algebras here, this is an example of these algebras. They were developed by Sklianin for quantum inverse scattering. That's all I know about quantum inverse scattering. They're also mentioned in a paper that has to do with mirror symmetry by I blanked on the names, Orlov, Kapustin, and another person whose name starts with K, so KKO, I think. They come up in physics, but I don't really understand how. But here they are. So they're generated by X, Y, Z with three quadratic relations. Okay, so you can think of these as, so these relations, we're going to set them equal to zero. And so it's like a polynomial ring in three variables, which is why we call it CP2. And we've got these funny non-commutative relations. So these are a lot more complicated than just skewed commuting. So there's three monomials in the relations. And so it makes life a lot more difficult. These when they came along, there weren't really techniques around to handle them. But it has lots of good properties. It has similar good properties to the other examples, good homological properties. It's a domain and so on. So I'm going to come back to that example several times later. But first of all, I just want to talk about how I think in my there's different kinds of non-commutative algebraic geometry out there. But the kind that I do, our main motivation is actually to study non-commutative algebras. And so we use algebraic geometry as a tool and as a kind of a motivator. So let me tell you some ways that algebraic geometry enters. So one problem is to classify algebras. So algebraic geometry comes up when you try and classify things that are defined algebraic, right? You want to classify, you know, seven-dimensional Lie algebras. That's a variety. Okay, so whenever you're trying to classify anything algebraic, it's very natural to have algebraic geometry appearing. And so the Sclion algebras that were just there a second ago, they're parametrized by a triple of an elliptic curve, an automorphism of that curve, and a degree 3 line bundle on the curve. So they're more geometric in the sense that it's not sort of flat or it's involving, say, zero curvature geometry. Classifying modules is another place where algebraic geometry comes up. And that's if you want, so these algebras, the Sclionian algebras, were studied and understood by looking at these point modules. And the point modules of Sclionian algebras are this elliptic curve, this invariant of the Sclionian algebra. And this was this was important in their study. So using this elliptic curve, for instance, people were able to show that the algebra was Noetherian. So they didn't know how to show it was Noetherian until this idea came along. And then another thing that where algebraic geometry, we get new problems and techniques from just considering standard constructions or ideas from algebraic geometry and using them for non-commutative algebras. So, but today I'm mostly going to be talking about the first two problems. In fact, this introduction, I just copied it from another talk, and I ended up talking about this one in the previous talk. So I moved the introduction to a different talk, and I have a different. We'll be talking about classifying algebras mostly today. And then there's applications, and so I won't be talking about that a lot today. And hopefully there'll be applications to physics. I mean, I know some of these things are definitely related to the kinds of things you get in physics. And there is applications to commutative algebraic geometry as well. But I don't think I'll be doing any of that today either. So today I want to talk about classifying algebras. So that is a particular kind of algebra that we think of as quantum projective spaces. So they're just like polynomial rings of a certain dimension. And so these are going to be algebras that are like polynomial rings of dimension D. They've got the same good homological properties. They have their domains. They look the same size and shape, but they're non-commutative. And so this is the definition. And it's graded. It's connected, meaning the degree zero part is K. And then this is the definition is it's regular. So regular meaning like a regular commutative ring is a polynomial is smooth. So here's the definition. I'm just going to run through these quickly and not really get into them in detail. So global dimension of A means that projective modules, or any module has a resolution of length D or smaller with projective modules. This is saying that the dimension of the graded pieces is going to grow polynomially, it has polynomial growth. And then there's this Gorenstein condition that the X look like this. And so if A is commutative, then the only one of these is just a polynomial ring. So these are really non-commutative generalizations of a polynomial ring. And they're classified in dimension smaller or equal than 3. So let me just show you a bit of that classification. So in dimension 2, there's just these are the only cases. And they're not really that interesting. I mean, actually, there's sort of homogenizations of the Weyl algebra and the Q-plane. But Actually, they come from an automorphism of PGL2. You pick a matrix in PGL2, and it's kind of, it's a twist. It's called a twisted homogeneous coordinate ring of P1 with PGL2. There are not very many of them. So dimension three, I'm not going to give you the list. There's a long list of different components. And the Sklenon algebra is the most interesting in the sense that it's the most kind of nonlinear, and it's the one that when it was first found by Artin Schelter, classified these algebras, but by looking at resolutions of K. And people, they didn't really know what to do with these Sklenon algebras. They didn't really have techniques for studying them. And so these are reclassified by Artin, Tate, and Vandenberg. And they used this idea of the point modules, and that allowed them to prove a lot more things about them and to have a lot more structure available. So you have just basic questions like whether these are Sklenon and algebras were Noetherian or not wasn't known until this classification was done. So in dimension four, there's no classification. And there's lots of known examples and families. I should mention this paper. These four authors here is one paper. Came out fairly recently in Duke, and they classify a certain special case. So there's certain partial classifications, and they use they classify the Kazuo duals, and they have to use A infinity Kazuo duals, and they write them down very explicitly. So they do a partial classification of some of these dimension four algebras. And some of these other people have listed various other families or done classifications of partial examples. And I'm not going to present to you a classification. This is an open problem. No one knows how to classify them all. Another thing maybe interesting for this audience is if you have a Poisson bracket on P3, you'd like to be able to deform, right? I mean, you can deform infinitesimally maybe, but you'd like to be able to find like a nice big family where you can actually put numbers in the parameters and to get some quantum or non-commutative P3s. And the known families include all of the Poisson brackets on P3. So the Poisson brackets on P3, the holomorph, or, you know, algebraic Poisson brackets, form a variety. It's a big variety, but it's the components of that variety have been classified independently by Bondel and Poliszczuk, neither of which is published. But those components, there's a family for each of those components that are known by these. By these people and others. There's other people who have worked on these things. So I want to talk about a particular, I'm going to spend my time here talking about a particular example of dimension four, which is another known family. I want to talk to you about it in some detail. It's far away from the commutative quantum P3. And I'll explain that a bit. So the ones with the Poisson brackets are kind of close to the one that you can, if you have a non-commutative P3 and you can get, if you're one of the families with the Poisson bracket, you can get there in a nice, like a smooth curve or something. But there's the ones I want to talk about, you can't get to P3 unless you turn a corner, basically. You have to change components. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a family called graded. It's both regular and graded Clifford algebras. And so basically I have to set up some notation before I get started. We're going to have a three tensor floating around. And we'll be looking at it in some detail. So I need a bunch of notation, and I need another parentheses there. So we're going to start with vector space of dimension n. We're going to pick n quadrics in it. Okay, and I need all this notation. This is the bilinear form associated to the quadric, and this is the function, quadratic function. And then the first thing I want to write down is a shriek here. So a shriek is going to be polynomials in V dual modulo these functions. Okay, so this would be just the homogeneous coordinate ring of the intersection of the quadrics. Okay, so we just take a bunch of quadrics and we intersect them. But unfortunately, this may be a bit odd. We've got n-dimensional vector space and n quadrics. And the intersection is going to be empty in projective space. So this is going to be, I want this to be a finite dimensional algebra. Okay. That doesn't always happen. I mean, you could do something silly like pick all the quadrics to be the same. And I don't want you to do that. You're forced. I want it to be a complete intersection. I want it to be the linear system to be base point free, which means I want this to give a finite dimensional algebra. Okay, so, and we're going to name the vector space spanned by these guys. So you can consider it, say, by these W's. We're going to call it PW. Okay, so that's going to be our base. So W will sit inside SIM2V. Okay, so it's just a vector space spanned by these guys. Okay. Oh, and I've switched to K now. Yeah, so K is a field. Algebraically closed, characteristic zero. Probably, actually, it doesn't have to be characteristic zero. Probably characteristic not two, I think, is fine for everything today. Okay, so I want to talk about some properties of the algebra. So first of all, I have to tell you what it is. And so this theorem is, a lot of people have looked at this algebra from various reasons or various points of view. And so this is just to go list some properties that are due to, you know, various people have studied these, and some of the statements I'm going to say, I'm not really sure which of these people to attribute it to. But first off, what the algebra I'm interested in is A, which is going to be the double dual, the Kazuel dual of the A shriek. See, I don't want to study the finite dimensional A shriek. I want to study its Kazuel dual, which is this. It's one way of writing it is this Unita algebra, which is, you know, it's complicated at first sight, but since it's Kazuel, it has a fairly simple presentation like this, where this wedge 2V is the commutative relations. It's saying that the guys in V commute, and this is the W's, this is the quadratic equation. So we're going to kill the commuting relations, and we're going to kill these quadratic relations. And I want to take the perpendicular of those inside V tensor V, with V tensor V dual. Okay, and that's going to be the relations I get. Okay, so that's a way of writing down the algebra, presenting it. It's a bit complicated, so there's another way of writing it down here that I'll get to after I just say these things. And so this is when you do Kazuel duality, you get this derived categories being dual. So that's a standard, and it's Artin-Schelter regular as long as the linear system is base point free, which I want to assume. And then here we have, this is another presentation of the algebra. Okay, so this is another way of looking at the same algebra. So up here, it's generated by V. And down here, I'm going to generate by V and by elements in W dual. Okay. And I want the generators in V, this little one here, I want them to have degree 1. And the generators here are going to have degree 2. And I put square brackets around this one and angle brackets here because these guys are going to be central. The guys in here commute with themselves and with everybody in V, okay? So this is supposed to look more like a Clifford algebra. So so lots of people here do differential geometry, and you've all seen Clifford algebras. So I want you to think of this equation as a Clifford algebra, except the problem is we've got too many quadratic forms, right? We've got extra quadratic forms. So we write down the usual relations of a Clifford algebra. So Wi is our bilinear form. And I'm going to add generators here, which are dual to these WIs. So this extra generator, it's got degree 2. And the reason it has degree 2 is it's going to make this nice and homogeneous, because this is just a number here. And so I've got these extra generators, and they're central. Okay, they commute with everybody. Okay, so this is it's like a vector-valued quadratic form, if you like. Okay, so this is a way of presenting the same algebra here. Well, another important point about this presentation is that this algebra has a large center. So all of those guys, W, in W dual here, commute with everybody. They're in the center. And in fact, they give you the center. This is the center of A. And the guys in V, there's finitely many over that. Just like the usual Clifford algebra, you need a finite number of Vs to generate the entire algebra with infinitely many W. So it's finite rank over this guy. Yeah. Yeah, that's another way of thinking of it. Although, to really have it really be universal, I should take all of the quadratic forms here. And I'm taking, I should take the whole sin2v, and I'm taking just a slice of it. So it's not, to break down the universal Clifford algebra, I should take the entire vector space sin2v. And so these guys should span the whole thing instead of just an n-dimensional slice of it. And the reason I just want it to be a certain size, basically. Okay, so because this guy has this center here, this KW dual thing here, is this polynomial is in the center, we can look at it as something over projective space, over this P3. This is going to be a P3. When we do that, we get a sheaf of algebras. And so this is finite. I said the V's, it's finite rank over the W's. And so it's giving us, it's a vector bundle over PW. So A tilde, this A holographic here, is a vector bundle over PW with an algebra structure. Okay? And it's actually the even Clifford algebra of, I've used this called a W, of this bundle of quadratic forms. So you can think of this as a bundle of quadratic forms, just like a metric, and you can take its even Clifford algebra. I guess I should warn you, it's not the same as a metric because you don't put vector fields into it and you don't get functions out. It's a quadratic form on a different vector bundle, and it takes values in a line bundle. So apart from those differences, it is like a metric. Okay, so it's like the even Clifford algebra of a metric on PW. Oh, and the other warning is it degenerates. It's definitely not going to be positive definite because we're working over, we don't use that kind of, it's not only not positive definite, it's going to degenerate at places. Okay, have determinant zero. Okay, last comment here about it has these properties. This is the Hilbert series, so it's the dimension of the graded pieces stuck together into a generating function, and it looks like this, and that's the same as projective space. So it's got the same size and shape as a commutative polynomial ring. That's what this is saying. Okay. So this is a theorem that these algebras, the family of those algebras, are a component of all of these Art and Shelter, these algebras we want to classify. They form a component of them. And that component's isomorphic to this, so it's just taking, this is a Grassmannian of n planes in sim2v dual, and so this is just, you pick some of these n quadratic forms, and you get a different algebra, and so those are, that as you vary that, you get these different algebras, and that forms a component of the space of all of these algebras. And to prove this, you compute the Hochschild cohomology of the Kazule dual, and the Kazule dual is the finite dimensional algebra. So you compute its Hochschild cohomology, you look at the degree zero part, and you take this family, and you compute the Kadira-Spencer map, and you can show that if you pick a sort of generic point, the Kadira-Spencer map gives you an isomorphism, and that allows you to conclude this. So here's just some examples. This in dimension 2, so this would be like a P1, is that's all you get. In dimension 3, a quantum P2, you get these are, this is the Skinner algebra's game, but now they're symmetric. And then lastly, in dimension 3, you could take three generators and just pick any six random symmetric relations, okay, something that looks like this with more variables. And that will give you some more examples. So I want to give you some more properties of these things, some more geometric properties they have. So the algebra, its center, so the center of the algebra I showed you is actually just polynomials. Okay, it's just a polynomial ring generated by the W duals. If you look at it projectively, its center is larger, meaning that if you localize and you take graded fractions, the center always gets larger. And so the actual center of this is a double cover of P3 ramified on this guy here. And this is, so I told you it's like you've got a metric, except the metric is degenerating. And so the rank of the metric, so it's on a four-dimensional vector space, the rank can go down to 3 or it can go down to 2. And if the rank goes down to 3, that's going to be a quartic surface inside this P3, and it's got a name. It's called a quartic symmetroid, that kind of variety. It just shows up classically. And so it's a certain kind of quartic that's given by one of these it's a sort of determinant of a symmetric 4x4 matrix of linear forms. And so that's a way of defining it. And what these quartic symmetroids have 10 ordinary double points. They're not in general position. So I should draw a picture of this. So we have P3, and we have some, this guy, we'll call it delta 3, and then we have points, 10 points like this, delta 2, and then the center is actually a double cover of this that's ramified along this surface inside P3. Okay, and if you localize, so the algebra A, you can think of it as living over here. So you have our algebra A here, and inside this Z, this is going to be a threefold over the P3. It's going to have singular points in it. It's going to have ordinary double points coming from the ordinary double points down below, which are called conifold singularities, threefold conifold singularities. And so this guy, the algebra A, locally at these points, is the conifold algebra. So I've heard different names for it. I'm thinking of it as a Clifford algebra. So it's the Clifford algebra of this quadratic form. It's also sometimes called the Atiyah-Flop algebra. It's a non-commutative resolution of the conifold, and so it came up in one of the previous talks. So it has that structure at these singular points. And everywhere else, it's isomorphic to matrices. So the algebra is, I think that's the next comment, it's as am I outside delta 2. So you've got this double cover of P3, and you've got this, the algebra is 2x2 matrices over that, except at these singular points where it's something else. And the thing that it is locally is this conifold algebra, or Atiyah-Flop algebra. And this variety, just some comments about it. This Z, the center variety, is Fano, and it's come up in it's one of the first examples. It's unirational and not rational. It's come up in paper of Art and Mumford. So it's appeared in places in algebraic geometry. Another interesting comment about it has no projective small resolution. It's smooth, right? So it's a kind of non-commutative P3. So somehow we're taking P3, we're forming a double cover of it, and putting something non-commutative on top of it, and that's a quantum P3 for some reason. And that quantum P3, the center has these singularities which are resolved by taking this non-commutative algebra. Those singularities, you can't find a small resolution. Okay, so you can't find a Krepert resolution or one that has just curves in the exceptional locus. You need to use divisors. Somehow the non-commutative resolution is better somehow. It's Krepert. So I want to talk about the linear modules and subalgebras of these guys. So this includes things like I mentioned point modules. I didn't tell you what they were yet, but point modules are a special kind of modules these algebras have. So here's the definition of a linear module of dimension D. So this is supposed to be points and lines on these non-commutative spaces. So what are points and lines and planes and things on them? So we define them to be modules that are quotients of the algebra. And so this means it's a left module. It's a quotient of the algebra. And it should have the right Hilbert series. So it should have the right graded pieces. So the dimension of the graded pieces should be the same as something linear. And I'm also going to make a definition here of linear subalgebras of dimension D. Okay, and so this is just going to be subalgebra, and it's going to have the same kind of Hilbert series too. So it should be something that looks like polynomials in two variables sitting inside polynomials in three variables. So something that has the same size and shape as that. So these things, the guys on top, the linear modules, I think of those as lines and points and planes inside the quantum P3. Whereas these subalgebras, I think of subalgebras as projections. So geometrically, if you say I've got polynomials in three variables sitting in polynomials in five variables, I think of that as a projection from P4 to P3. That's the interpretation for these things. So let me give you some examples of what these look like. So LAD, this is going to be the space. I'm being vague there, but it's going to be these things. There's schemes that parameterize these, or I'll just say varieties. But there's you can prove that there are these things cut out varieties. Technically I should say schemes, but I think I'll say varieties instead. And here's some examples of what they are. So if we take dimension 3, that's like these symmetric Scleonian algebras, then you get an elliptic curve of these point modules. And in dimension 4, so that's a quantum P3, you have 20 points, so there's 20 point modules, and the variety parameterizing lines is some surface. Okay, so the variety parameterizing line modules is some projective surface. So I read a paper that said this, and they wrote down some equations for the surface, and I was unsatisfied because I wanted to know which surface it is, because algebraic surfaces are classified. There's a list of the possible surfaces you can get, so I wanted to know what surface it was. And so what I wanted to talk about next is which surface it actually is. It's a surface, and it's determined by this four-dimensional space of quadrics in P3. So again, this is the data we used. So this is actually the name of the surface. It's got a fancy name from it appeared classically in algebraic geometry. And here's the data again that defines the algebra. So I'm going to leave the algebra alone, and I want to talk about this classical bit of algebraic geometry that I found looking to figure out what this surface would be. And so it's called the ray congruence, and it's built out of the same kind of data. Okay, we've got four quadrics in P4, and the fancy word here is web. So a pencil is a P1 worth of divisors, or a linear system dimension 1 is a pencil, and then the next word is a two-dimensional linear system is a net, and a three-dimensional linear system is called a web. So anyway, you've got four quadrics. And the first thing you do is you're going to take those four quadrics, and you intersect that with P3 cross P3. So P3 cross P3 sits naturally in P of V tensor V. And we can take these bilinear forms, and we can take the points that are polar, like perpendicular with respect to this quadratic form for all on. Okay, so that's just taking P3 cross P3, intersecting it with four linear hyperplanes. Okay, that gives us a K3 surface. So we get this K3 surface here. And it doesn't meet the diagonal. Okay, and I know it doesn't meet the diagonal because I want it to be a complete intersection. I want it to be base point free because there's no point inside there's no point that lies inside all of the quadrics, so it's not going to meet the diagonal. And it's easy to check it's K3. It's a standard adjunction. So this surface, it's given by pairs of points in P3. It's in P3 cross P3. And it doesn't hit the diagonal, so I can map it to lines in P3. So this, I'm going to call it G24, this Grassmannian, but it's the Grassmannian of lines in P3. So this, we have this map to lines. And the image, we'll call it E, is an Henrique surface. So Henrique surface, we'll take as the definition of an Henrique surface is it's a smooth projective algebraic surface that has a universal cover that is K3. So it's going to be a double cover. So that's one definition. So they're always, any Henrique surface is, I can say the same thing again. It's a quotient of a K3 surface by a fixed point free involution. I mean, that's another, well, it's the same thing essentially, but it's a definition of a Henrique surface. So what I want to do now, so that's a particular, that's a surface E. Okay? I'm going to look at the same surface in a different way. So here's the same surface from a different point of view. So we'll take a line in PV. Okay? So we just take a line with pair points on it, x, y. And we've got a quadric here, q, and w is its bilinear form. That line is going to sit in qw if this holds, right? That's saying the point x is on the quadric, the point y is on the quadric, and the x and y are perpendicular with respect to that, polar respect to that quadric. So this gives us three linear conditions on w, right? Three things we need to be zero. So it's three conditions on the quadric. So what does that say? That means if we pick, so we've got our base pw, and we've got PV here, and we've got this family like this, and we're looking at quadrics here like that. Okay, so we've got some family of quadrics in PV lying over PW. That's our setup information, one way of looking at our what we start with. So if we pick a line in PV, so I pick a line here, and this these are both P3. I mean, they're both P3, but I have to call them different things, or life would be very confusing. So I pick a line in this P3 here in the PV, and I look at which quadrics it lives in. Okay, it's usually going to live in just a single quadric because it's three linear conditions on the base space. So it will usually be a unique quadric that lives in. But if I'm lucky, that line may live in a line's worth of quadrics downstairs. Okay, so I know they all look the same, but those quadrics are moving around, and they may or may not contain that line. And so if we're lucky, that line in PV will be in a line's worth of quadrics in the W, PW. Okay, so if we take the lines, all the lines in PV that happen to lie in a quadric, a line's worth of quadrics, then that's going to give us a variety, E prime, and it's called the ray congruence. And so the theorem is that those are the same surfaces. Okay? It's E and E prime are both the same thing, and it's an Henrique surface. And so I'm going to sketch the proof of this. So if we take a line in E prime, so the definition was that it's in a line worth of quadrics in PW. Okay, so there's a line, we'll call it PU, so we have a name for the vector space. So this is just going to be a P1 worth of quadrics that contain that line. So this web of quadrics W and PV is going to give us a pencil of quadrics here. Okay, what we do is we just take the quadrics in L and we intersect with QW. And so it gives a pencil. So L is just a line, and so quadrics and a line are just a pair of points. Okay, so what we're going to do is intersect QW with L, and we get a pair of points, but it's only going to depend on W mod U, because the guys in PU, the quadrics in PU, contain the line. Okay, so the quadrics that live in here contain the line, and so their equation is zero on the line, the ones out here don't. And so that you can mod out by the U. Okay, and so we get a pencil of quadrics, and this is a P1 as well. So whenever you have a pencil of quadrics, you can diagonalize it. So you can write it like this in a diagonal way for a pair of points, X, Y, and L. And now these guys are because there's no X, Y term here, they're going to be polar with respect to all of the quadrics. Okay? So that line, they're fine for the ones that L is contained in, then they're automatically polar for those. And then for the ones that L are not contained in, they're polar because we can diagonalize this. And so what we've done is we've found a pair of points that are polar with respect to all of the quadrics, perpendicular with respect to all of the four quadrics. And so that gives us a point in the K3 surface X. Okay? So we've found that this guy has a double cover, which is a K3 surface X. This is a very classical theorem. It's an exercise in Bovell's book on complex surfaces. Okay, so why am I mentioning this? So it's going to connect back, obviously. So if you have one of these regular graded Clifford algebras, then it turns out that the lines on it is given by this incidence correspondence. So it's a linear it's a n minus d plane in V, a d plane in that should be a capital W, so that the line is inside the quadrics for all the quadrics in this. Okay, so you have a pair LW, and so this what was a line a minute ago is inside the quadrics for all the quadrics in U. Okay, so this incidence correspondence is going to be the variety of linear like lines or points or whatever in that algebra of dimension D. And it turns out it's the same as the subalgebras. Okay, this is how they're the same. You kill the generators for the line, or you take the subalgebra generated by those things. So I'll come back to this thing, the fact that they're the same. That doesn't usually happen for these guys. That's a bit unusual. And it's neat. I think it's neat. I think it's neat because it says that if you have a point or a line in your place, you can project away from it. So we usually can't do that. I mean, usually if we have a point, we can't project away from a point. But that's something very basic you can do in algebraic geometry that we can't usually do with these non-commutative things. But for this particular family, we can. So once we know this description, here's some corollary, some information we can get from this. So if you look at hyperplanes, so codimension one thing, so what kind of hyperplanes do you have? You always have a full set. So being a hyperplane is easy. There's nothing to check for that. But more interesting is the codimension two. So this would be, so we talked about points in a quantum P2 was an elliptic curve, and then the in dimension three, the quantum P3, we had this projective surface. Well, it turns out it's always going to be a quotient of a Calabi-Yau by a fixed point free involution. It's always going to look like that. So it's like this K3 modulo, a quotient of a K3 by a fixed point free involution. And that happens in general. And the proof is the same as the exercise in Bovell. It's the same proof, except you make the numbers a bit different. So in general, as you change these numbers, the n and the d you have available here, so n being the dimension of this and the d is this, it's going to be empty when n is small and d is large by this inequality here. And that's you can check by looking at, so when quadrics are large, you know, they have isotropic spaces of roughly half the dimension. And in order to have small things like points and lines on them, they need to have isotropic space is a very large dimension, and that's what the incidence correspondence says, and that's not going to happen when the quadrics are large. Another corollary here, as I was mentioning, is that you can pull back. So you can project. So if you have a point, you can project away from it to something, but then you can pull back points and lines and things from the thing you project to. So I want to draw a picture of that. So if we have some kind of one of these quantum P3s, and we pick a point in it, we can project away, we'll get one of these quantum P2s, and we'll have an elliptic curve worth of points, and we get a bunch of lines that pass through this. So we'll get lines in the quantum P3 that pass through the point parameterized by that elliptic curve. So just like you can do in regular commutative algebraic geometry, that's easy and obvious, but I mean, it's you can do it here as well. So the last couple of things here. Here's a toric example. It's kind of cute. Just to make a specific example that you can see very explicitly. So this is the web of quadrics. Okay. So I felt like I should use kind of more physics-y or differential geometry physics notation, where I should have upper and lower indices. But then I decided I didn't want it. Really, these guys are the duals, and then I'd have to square. I have to write x upper 4 squared, and so I decided to use big and small letters for my duals. But anyway, so here, first of all, this is the quadrics I'm going to kill. I just kill all the squares of the variables. Okay, so that's a finite dimensional commutative algebra, and its Kazule dual is the algebra we're interested in, and it's just skew commuting. All the variables skew commute with each other. So it's a very simple non-commutative algebra. But this analysis we've talked about works fine. It's just kind of degenerate in this case, so it becomes very combinatorial or toric. And so the K3 surface is not an honest-to-goodness K3 surface. It's a degeneration. And the place where the quadratic form degenerates is the coordinate tetrahedron, and degenerates on the coordinate lines, has even lower rank on the coordinate lines. And the K3 surface inside P3 cross P3, if you look at it, it's not a real K3 surface. Now it has components, and the components, so it's a union of 8 P2s and 6 P1 cross P1s. So it's a union of those varieties. Those are its irreducible components. And the way they're arranged is, if you think of the P2s as a triangle and the P1 cross P1s as a square, they're arranged in a caboctahedron. That's how the components intersect each other, okay, which is quite natural from a toric geometry point of view. And then the ray congruence you get is also kind of natural from a toric point of view. These are its components, so it should be, this should be a double cover of it, right? It should be a quotient of this by a fixed point free involution. And you just take the, it's the antipodal, you take the caboctahedron and you take the antipodal quotient, and then that's what you get for this. So you get this many P2s and P1 cross P1s, and the way they intersect is described by this. And so the last, so just to finish up, just to mention some open questions about these things. So the big, I don't really know a whole lot about what these varieties look like. So I would like to know more about them. So I've described them slightly, but as it gets, I think I've described the sort of the easiest cases of them. Okay, I don't know much about them in general. Another question here is, so I said we have this component. These guys form a component of all of these quantum P3s. Okay, so we have some notion of these quantum P3s. We have this one family I've been talking about forms some component. And it's far away from the P3, meaning you can't get there without changing components. Okay, you have to change to another component, and then you can get there. What I'd like to understand better is, so I know if I pick a random point in this component and I try and deform, I'm stuck there. I stay inside that because it's a component. Okay, I proved that. But I'd like to know where I can move. So where does it intersect the other components? And I mean, so I know, for example, that toric example that we just looked at here, this guy has lots. I can just throw a Q in there. Okay, I can stick in QIJs there. He's got lots of deformations, and I can send him to P. It's the commutative P3 by taking sticking in QIJs there and sending them to -1. So he's got lots of deformations. I don't know when the quadrics have deformations and when they don't. I mean, here's a condition in terms of the Hochschild cohomology, but I'd like to understand it better geometrically. And this is a big prize. There's people working on this, and I think there has to be some insight or something to really make progress with this. I'm not sure. Some new invariant or something. So I don't really know what to do with this problem, but it's a big prize. Then this is something I'm working on, which is trying to prove some of these other families are components. And so I had a student work on programming the Hochschild cohomology computation, so we could programming the Kodaira-Spencer map. So we take a family, we plug it into the computer, and it tells us whether the Kodaira-Spencer map is surjective or injective or what, and then that using that, you can actually prove you have a component. Anyway, that's it. So thank you for your patience. Yeah, the K3s are very, very specific, right? They're inside P3 cross P3, and they're cut out by Like if you just take four linear hyperplanes, you get a K3, but they can't be arbitrary. They have to be these symmetric tensors, right? So yeah, and they actually, the other Calabi-Yaus that of higher dimension occur in this, almost the same kind of way. So it's again, it's in PN cross PN, and you're slicing linear hyperplanes. They're symmetric. So it's a very special type of Calabi-Yau, which, I mean, it can't be general either. I mean, so these Enrique surfaces as well are not the general Enrique surface. They're the codimension one family inside all Enrique surface. So you have to have it special just to even have this quotient exist. And then it's special among there as well. So it's not a very general Calabi-Yau at all. It's really hard. If I have a curve, basically, and I want to stick it in something higher dimensional, what I've got to do is, so I would think of a curve as I've got some generators and some relations, and to stick it in something bigger, I've got to remove relations, okay? And it's very difficult to remove relations. There are some instances where you can do this, but actually, curves are not so bad. So I take back what I said a bit. I mean, let's take an elliptic curve and make a high. First off, curves are commutative automatically. So there's a few theorems, a few different theorems that say there are no non-commutative curves. So if we're starting with a curve, we're in kind of in good shape because we're going to start with something commutative. But then I could take, say, some high degree quadratic embedding of an elliptic curve. And then if I want, so I've got a bunch of quadratic relations. I want to lift it to something non-commutative. It's kind of not clear how to get rid of relations in a way that will do that. You can put them all in. So you can take all of these quantum P2s and you can stick them in quantum P3s in a very specific way. So there's a paper about that. And it includes, so basically you take the quantum P2 and you adjoin a new variable and that variable commutes with these variables, but you can classify what kind of new relations you get. And then that example, actually, that family you get that way is one of the ones that parameterizes the Poisson brackets, one of the components of the Poisson brackets on P3. It includes all the non-commutative deformations of cubic surfaces. So you get a very interesting family that way. For a specific question like that, you can do things. But in general, it's hard. It's very difficult, yeah. By increasing the size of the space, or sometimes you can deform, right? I mean, if you you can't always, I guess. So these examples, you're far away from something commutative. You have a large center, and so you can actually describe things quite simply. But on the other hand, you're not actually close to anything commutative. So it really depends on the kind of algebra you have.